Hello, this is James, and welcome to Always Already Podcast After Dark. I've got some of the co-hosts with me here. John.
Hi, everybody. It's John.
And Emily.
Hi. This is funny because we can all see each other.
We're all on Skype in three different states.
I forgot for a second there that you all were looking at me because, like, I had my head turned, but I'm like, what difference does it make? You're actually there, so I'm gonna break the fourth wall, I guess. Keep looking back at you.
There are no walls in cyberspace, James.
Yes.
Or are there?
Or are there?
Well, see, this kind of you're leading us into some kind of like quandary. Or like the Twilight Zone.
What I think that's maybe other than leading us into quandaries.
We kind of have entered the Twilight Zone, right? Because it's 1 week since. You like that? Skillful. That was good. That's professional. It's been 1 week since our new president-elect, Donald J. Trump, has... I can't even say it.
We all made faces, for the record, cast fam.
Donald J. Trump.
Can I interrupt for just a second? I have said this to several friends, and everyone keeps telling me I just don't remember 2008 well enough, but I feel like the term president-elect was not used with as much frequency as it has been in this particular moment.
We are going to drag this out and just delay the reality. He is not yet president.
Exactly.
But I thought...
Is it just me?
I don't know. I feel like I'm definitely pointing it out. Like, personally, I'm using president-elect to remind
more intentionally.
We're almost in the Twilight Zone. But, like, it's just the beginning of the beginning right now. But this episode of Always Already After Dark is our attempt at catharsis, I guess.
Yes.
Our personal catharsis.
Collective.
Our, like, collective catharsis. Well, like, I was going to nest out, right? Okay. So individually, I need to talk it out.
Yeah.
And so then as a collective, as hosts, we're going to have our own catharsis. And then through extension with all of our listeners, they're hopefully going to be able to participate in this with us, this cathartic ritual.
Yes. And B, too. B is most likely coming if they are able to. We are having some technical difficulties on the B Altman end. But hopefully B will be here also.
And B is with us in spirit. Yes. One way or the other.
And B
Rachel.
Yes. As is Rachel.
Rachel defends her dissertation next week. So, like, send her some good vibes, folks.
Oh, wait. I'm making a gesture. No one can see it on my radio.
I can see it. Rachel can see it in her mind.
Huzzah. Indeed. Yeah. Shall we begin?
We'll begin. All right. So I have a question that is maybe not helpful to begin with, but I'm going to begin with it. And that is, so like one of the things that was very noticeable to me after last week was that I think that I am not one to ever doubt the like racism and sexism and nationalism of the United States of America. And yet, I was still surprised that Donald Trump was elected. Like,
I was utterly shocked.
Like, and the answer might be just that, of course, John, you are a white person, in which case, just tell me that and we can move on to the next thing. But, like, that was one of the things that, like, kept hitting me in the last week.
But I think for me, sure, yes, Emily, you are also a white person, but also, yes, Emily, you live in New York City. Yes, Emily, your entire extended family is on the opposite coast of California. I think this like speaks to the problem we've been having about like, is this really the time to isolate a variable or is this the time to embrace like the non kind of scientific explanations for why shit goes down? You know, I don't know.
I think I was surprised like discreetly. Like, on the night, like, as it was unfolding, I was just like, oh, really? Like, you know, especially, like, I'm in Virginia, and, you know, they were not able to call Virginia until very late. And so that was surprising, because we had all kind of expected it to go for Hillary kind of solidly here. But I feel like I got tipped off. I don't know if we – can we mention other, like, media sources or, like –
There are, well, what other media legally? Sources, James? I don't know. There are no, there's no other media than the Always Already podcast. That's how everybody gets their news is old episodes of the Always Already podcast.
But also, we're not incorporated, so be aware that our if we get sued, it's our own personal.
Okay, so I'm not going to, it's actually, like,
I'm kidding.
I guess, if it's a, it's like a plug, if anything. But so I listened to the Young Turks, like, religiously. And about a week before the elections, the Young Turks really started, like, sounding the alarm because there were these, like, trends in the last-minute polls that were just not looking good for Hillary. And especially, like, even that last weekend here in Virginia, though, like, I had some of my friends try to calm me down and be like, oh, it was one outlier. But Hampton University had a poll, like, Friday before the election that had Trump up by 3 points in Virginia. So I just started – I'm always a pessimist, right? I'm an Afro-pessimist at heart. And I was just like, you know what, like, in the last moment here, as, like, as the hype intensified around the, like, the unthinkable can't happen, I was like, it's going to fucking happen. Because as soon as you set it up as, like, the unthinkable, like, I just feel like that's when, like, the cosmic trickster just, like, says, oh, well, guess what?
But
you
also
have to think about it.
But that's also the, like, irony of language, right? In naming something as unthinkable, it's automatically, like, isolated and sort of condensed as something that's now thinkable, right? Because because we've put language to its unthinkability, it's now a thinkable possibility. It's now a potential.
Yeah, I think, like, there's something to be said about the this condensation aspect, that, like, once it's been kind of earmarked or something, right? Like, I guess in hindsight, right, like, there's Brexit and there's, like, a awful right, like, dictator in the Philippines. And, like, so we shouldn't be surprised,
right, in the case of Turkey.
Right. So, like, that the U.S. is part of a global thing is not surprising. It's like, and it's all not surprising, but, like, the night of, though, it's just like, come on now. This can't actually honestly be happening.
Yeah, I think there's also space to think about the kind of the different ways that different kinds of affects work on you, right? So on the one hand, we can say, as people who study political, cultural, social phenomena of some sort in some, we hope, meaningful way, that there were signs, right? We weren't in our heart of hearts or minds of minds or mind hearts of mind hearts, we weren't, like, utterly surprised.
Right.
And yet the, like, I think that's a different affect maybe than the sort of, like, sadness and rage that then comes from having that kind of deeply held suspicion confirmed, right? That people are actually as terrible as you hoped that they weren't.
Or, you know, what?
It's maybe, like, the affective difference is the difference between shock and surprise.
Oh, right? Interesting.
And for me, it was more shock than surprise.
Yeah, okay.
So, and maybe that gets back to, like, what is thinkable and not thinkable.
Right.
But, like, you know, abstractly, I had contemplated President-elect Donald J. Trump. Right. But, like, when that condensed, to use the language of the conversation we were just having, when that condensed into, like, a mode of reality, like, that bypassed the surprise that is more mediated and went to, like, a more visceral shock.
You know what? I think maybe in some, like, I'm not surprised that there's racism that can be, like, operationalized and interpolated and, like, ready to go in almost 2017. But I think there is a little bit of, like, surprise / disappointment that I thought there was more of us who could, like, stand against that. And I know, like, there's probably more people who don't believe that way because, like, 46% of the country didn't even vote, right? But I thought that there was at least going to be, like, you know, there's enough of us who are, like, coming out to decidedly say no to that rhetoric, and that we're not, see, I can't even say this. I guess we are the majority, though, right? Like, we are numerically the majority, just not.
Who's the we?
Like, the we as, like,
the, well, I think that's the point.
Won the popular vote, right? Like, so there are more of us who didn't vote for him. But yet, here we are.
But there are more of us that believe that the rhetoric of usness is irrelevant to a Donald J. Trump success or failure at a run for presidency, and yet it didn't turn out that way. The us didn't prevail over the capital U S us. Or I don't know what the right metaphor is. I'm
this just
been not
does that you know
thickness thinking stuff lately.
The condescension, condescension.
Ooh, what a slip.
Wow. Maybe there's definitely, that's going on in this country too. But like, there's so many different variables at play. Cause like, you could say that there was voter suppression in the South because the Voting Rights Act was repealed.
In the state that I live in Wisconsin, right? Where turnout was right? lower than it was in 2012.
So,
like, where there were new voter ID laws and lots of confusion, like.
There's that. I hesitate only because, like, I am the pessimist, but, like, I want my pessimism to be real in that, like, there are no other options but the pessimist premise, right? And so there are all these other problems that, like, it's not, like, so the people who got suppressed and then the fact that there are more raw numbers of votes that went against Trump. Like, maybe the narrative coming out of this shouldn't be, like, that racism is taken back over again or something, but that, like, it was able to manipulate the structure of a system that was already kind of bent towards racism anyway. But, like, there are all these other things. It wasn't, like, if there really was, like, 60% of the voting populace that went out and voted for Trump in a landslide, like, that would be very different, I think, than, like, the way he wins is on, like, technicalities and, like, voting irregularities, and it's not, like, the majority of the people that I have to walk around and look at every day. Hey, this is what I need to tell myself. It's not one out of every two people that I see on the street. It's, like, one out of every three or four, maybe.
Yeah, one out of every four of them, right?
That's right, because it was, like, 25% of the people that voted for Trump, actually. So, yeah, it's really just one out of four, not one out of two.
But it also is drastically different depending on where you live. Like, it's definitely not one out of four here.
Where are you again? I'm sorry.
I'm in New York City.
The city that nobody's heard of. I don't know.
New York City.
New York City.
The last time we were on.
I don't know. I read.
Dark. You were in, like, Oregon or something, right?
I was in California. I was in the Bay Area. Yes.
Okay, so still a coastal elite. But.
Yes.
I was actually in Berkeley, California last time, so, so not drastically different demographically from. Like, yeah.
Progressivism.
Yeah, my two little cousins go to Malcolm X High Elementary School, and they are, like, very avid advocates of Black Lives Matter. They're 8 and 6, by the way.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's different. It's different.
So you're in Wisconsin, John.
I am.
You're in so-called flyover country, and you're in a state that, surprisingly, like, Hillary didn't campaign in Wisconsin at all.
No, not once.
Now, here, why did she not? Let's get to it, because we, so far, listen, Hillary was our best kind of, like, roadblock to Trump. But I think there's a reason why Hillary could not campaign in Wisconsin and win on the issues, and that's because she does represent, like, global neoliberal trade deals and deindustrialization, and, like, she doesn't have, like, the problem of neoliberalism that stands behind this election. That's probably why she, like, I don't know, right? Or did she think she had the, like, the unions in Wisconsin and they didn't have to deal, like, didn't have to get on the ground there?
I mean, what? It's like, you know.
Did she treat it as flyover country? She did.
There's,
right?
Like, well, there's, like, the direct explanations and the, like, broader explanations, right? The direct explanations are something to the effect of, like, you know, Wisconsin has voted for the Democrat in presidential elections, like, many, several elections in a row, that, you know, there's a large number of college students, that there's, you know, like, that there was no, that the polling indicated she didn't need to come here. Like, there are all these, like, quote-unquote reasons, right? But I think that, like, you know, the point of this podcast or the point of us having this conversation, in addition to the catharsis, is, like, what are the reasons behind the reasons, which is very paranoid reading of me. But, like, you know, so maybe neoliberalism is one of those, but as funny as it is, like, I am usually the first person to be like, oh, hashtag neoliberalism, and, like, mean it. I don't, you know, I agreed with most of, like, the Naomi Klein piece that was going around and that James, you suggested kind of be one of the focus points of the conversation. All right, so if there's a weird cut right there, it's because we're now joined by Bea Altman. Hi, Bea.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, B.
Weird editing. I was talking to a couple of students the other day about, like, what does a response to Trump look like? And we were talking about the idea of, like, a diversity of tactics. And, like, my line with them was basically that, you know, we need everything from the, like, yuppie, middle-aged white yuppies, like, out of very, very, like, low-key protests to, like, community organizing to, like, whatever other kinds of protests you want to participate in. And, like, that I feel pretty certain with. But what I haven't been able to figure out is, like, do we also want or need a diversity of, like, explanations of Trump, right? Because just saying, you know, it's, oh, it's neoliberalism and everything else is a manifestation of the neoliberalism, or, oh, it's white nationalism or whiteness and everything else is just a manifestation of that. Like, none of those answers have felt quite sufficient for me.
Yeah, for me, neither. I mean, so a couple of classes so far, especially in radical organizing and the politics of embodiment, has been centered around the notion that, you know, the creation of space.
Sorry, we're good. Keep going, B. We're trying to send subliminal messages about the one of us who is typing.
I was like, oh, what am I saying? I'm saying something wrong. It's the creation of space also in certain kinds of public university settings, for instance, Purchase College, where, you know, I predominantly teach. Has been issuing statements, not the administration, but rather student government organizations saying that we have safe spaces for trans students. We have safe spaces for folks who feel that they are at risk of certain kinds of violences that have been validated, if not authorized, by a Trump presidency. And that beyond all of that, talking through how one might contact Albany, one might contact city councils, one might actually contribute, if not benefit from, a multitude of activist organizations that at this point, specifically, you know, for my studies, trans organizations are providing pro bono counseling help for a variety of needs for trans folks, including securing documentation, securing sex marker changes, securing health insurance. And they're doing that in terms of both counseling as well as representation. So I think that, you know, it's a multi-axial approach, creating the space on campus, creating the space in certain kinds of communities. But given the fact that, you know, we're all teaching, right, that's where I saw it first. That's where I heard it first, is that students were some of the first folks to have this kind of response. And I thought that was amazing. But yeah.
I think there's something kind of interesting too about our training or brainwashing as academics that, like, makes us search, right? The first thing we want to do is say why. And I think we have this amazing vast of resources at our disposal. Freud again. At our disposal. And that I think there is a temptation, in spite of how much we want to embrace kind of grayness or the multi-layered nature of the way things work, there is a temptation to be like, well, what's the real reason, right? And
well, you know,
that's the Sedgwick episode.
Exactly, exactly.
Can I? You I just want to.
Oh, go ahead,
D. Oh, sorry. No, I just wanted to say, like, no one in my class brought up neoliberalism. You know what they brought up? I fear my, you know, sister is being deported. I fear that I'm going to lose access to hormones. I fear that my everyday life is going to be interrupted as a result, not just of Trump as a president and his administrative duties as contained in Article 2 of the Constitution, but rather what it represents in terms of state politics and what it represents in terms of how we are to move forward. And people were distraught. And so it's interesting. So it's, you know, as someone from that pedagogical angle from our last, John, you were mentioning Sedgwick, from the pedagogical angle, you know, it seemed to kind of detract when I spoke about neoliberalism. It seemed to detract from the conversations about it.
Conversations, right? Like, I mean, I well, wasn't asking because I think students there, to diagnose neoliberalism.
No, of course not. What I think that, but there is a kind of, there is an overlapping there that we can make. But, you know, hearing the lived experiences of folks who are coming forward and saying, look, these are the moments that that my family or that I'm, you know, experiencing firsthand, you know, creates a, you know, this whole other universe that, look, bottom line, as folks in graduate school, a lot of in many instances, we have a tendency to, you know, just merely look at. Right. Merely look at, theorize, et cetera. I don't know. I say this just, you know, in the sense of the week of having to speak to students and counsel them in such a way to say, this is how American political institutions work. So that you do not have to fear, and at the same time, sort of tempering my own perspectives and my own kinds of fears. You don't have to fear an authoritarian governmental regime, right? Which seems
that's the promise of American.
Well, I mean, like, no, that could be the promise, but at the same time, it's like working against. Like, I had to actually say, one might have faith, but at the same time, one might believe in the so-called checks and balances that are built into the constitutional system. But one also fears the fact that, you know, the party system that has been created, that emanated out of the institutions created by the constitutions, thus endogenous institutions, they like to say in American political science, you know, has kind of, they're reaping what they've sown as a result. So,
well, can I, okay, I'll respond to that point, but then I want to back up to the neoliberalism thing.
Yes.
But just to that point, I think I felt a little bit like I had to play some of that role with my students, and just that, like, you are some, you know, we are, I don't like, I'm too much of an anarchist, but to say this, but we are authority figures in the classroom, right?
Yeah,
right. And so you have to kind of, like, if you come in and, like, your seams are unraveling, then, like, theirs are going to be, like, shredded, right? So
yeah,
I do. So, like, there was, but I will say, for the purpose of this podcast now, that all three branches of government are in the hands of the GOP. Like, I don't know what they interpret as far as constitutional limits versus what I would interpret. And I just feel like that whole thing now is up in the air. As soon as Ruth Bader Ginsburg is gone, or if Trump puts on another SCOTUS judge that, like, Obama's not filled yet, then, like, we are really fucked, because they have a very different interpretation as to, like, how far the Constitution's provisions of, like, civil liberties go and whatnot. So, like, there is an issue here, right, that is real. But then, like...
Right, and just purely procedural.
Well, also, like, the fact that there are, like, 97 openings in the federal appellate and district court positions alone that haven't been filled, something along those lines, that are still yet to be filled. I mean, that's terrifying. Sorry, James, I didn't...
there are other non-official institutional political channels that we need to, like, harness, because we don't... Those checks and balances are at least under... extra threat right now than, like, maybe in other times. But then, like, so here's the thing, I think, like, just generally about neoliberalism. Neoliberalism is not a thing, right? Like, it's a heuristic of complex, our inner articulating global and local dynamics that, right, of all different kinds. So, like, just neoliberalism is just another, like, bundle of complexity. And, like, it can't be the the explanation for Trump any more than racism can be the explanation, because these are not singular explanations. They are their own complex phenomena. And what we're really just saying is, like, this condensation again, right? Like, there's just some congealing of things that went into Trump. Neoliberalism might get you at some dimensions of that. Racism might get you at others, which would articulate with neoliberalism in one way or another. Right?
Yeah, but like, just listen to James's interview with Lester Spence.
Yeah, right. Right? Yeah, but like, but it just becomes so
epistemic and ruling.
It's a cluster, to borrow Hillary's term. This, like, basket of deplorables, right? Like, this is the basket of deplorables, and I'm counting her in the basket, too, because she's also being, like, swept along by these global currents. And so pointing out any one of these things, I don't know. But, like, I think, B, you're absolutely right in that, like, the effect of this, like, with students. I had students in my class because, like, my class is Africana Studies and Latin American Studies cross-listed, so I had Latin American Studies majors in there, too. And so, like, DACA students and, like, people who know DACA students are at least one degree of separation. And three or four students are in the class crying because they themselves or they know people who are DACA students who are only going to be guaranteed to be in this country for maybe another year or so. And then their entire college career is up in the air again, right? And, like, you're right. Like, in that kind of situation, you're heuristic. I don't care. Like, they right. don't care. They just need something tangible.
Mm-hmm. And it becomes a real issue where one starts to have to think that, you know, we have questions presented to us in any kind of field. How do these institutions work? How do bills become laws? That was a question in my intro to women's and gender studies classes, right? It's like, and then one starts to realize, oh,
I'm sorry, yeah. I was laughing. I was just thinking about Schoolhouse Rock.
I think that everyone should show it. Yes, only, John, you're right.
If only the American political system was as hunky-dory as Schoolhouse Rock made it out
but
to
you know,
be.
It's so strange because it's like, yeah, it's hunky-dory, but they caught it in the sense of, like, behind these closed doors, these discussions are being had, and this is ultimately what becomes of me, the bill, and that, you know, it runs back and forth, and then all of a sudden there are these things that have kind of institutional roadblocks associated with them. That was the only thing I believe that brought people down a few notches to say, oh, okay, well, then I can think about organizing at the local level. Then I can think that not all things are lost. Then I can think about perhaps contacting, you know, my legislature, whether it be city council, mm-hmm. Whether it be, you know, the you're, of course, here in New York, the borough president office, or, you know, Albany. Or traveling to hear these kinds of conversations that are being had in the specific meetings that are posted online. Most people didn't even know that they were public, that you could attend them, that you could make, you could schedule conversations. I think that this was a kind of, it was an eye-opening moment for a number of folks, but it was terrifying at the same time because it just revealed the degree to which folks don't either overestimate certain kinds of powers, but at the same time feel that their own power has been lost. And that in itself is so dramatically powerful. It broke me. Because, you know, as someone's like been teaching, you know, John, it's like, I've been teaching what American politics since 2008, doing game theory work for crying out loud in American politics. And then thinking to myself, oh Lord, this is what, you know, this is the outcome of an election that I never thought would ever have, you know, been the case. I'm sure that you probably covered this kind of territory before. I'm sorry that I'm coming in you know, 23 minutes late, and I don't even have Skype on my MacBook because my hard drive got wiped out.
Hashtag neoliberalism.
Hashtag
planned obsolescence.
Right? Exactly. I wonder why. Huh? Emily.
Can I say that I think, though, that exactly what you're pointing to, the sort of like feedback between the feeling of powerlessness and the sort of on the ground political move to combat that, is one of the reasons why the neoliberal explanation is compelling, but also one of the things I find troubling about focus on just the neoliberal aspect and kind of relegating the sort of sexism, misogyny, homophobia, transphobia, insert every phobia into some other realm that has not that is not related to the neoliberal paradigm or the neoliberal problem, right? Because you can, I think it makes perfect sense to say that the way the economy has worked on many people in the US has made space for people to distrust institutions generally, even if we're unclear about which institutions are actually responsible for our current economic predicament, right?
But wait, do you think that, like, in some way there, like, you could, and like, this is just for the purpose of us now being like academics and kind of thinking this through a bit, like pushing those other issues back into neoliberalism, in that, like, the rejection of identity politics is because, like, identity politics and multiculturalism and free trade agreements go hand in hand, right? And like the idea of, like, that's like the historicity of Obama as the first Black president, and then being followed up by Hillary as the first woman president. And like, if there is a racist backlash and a misogynistic backlash that is also being styled through like working class angst, like, it's all kind of, you're rejecting all of that. You don't care about the history, like, of the first woman or the first race, because you see all of that as being part of like that elite coastal
I don't know about that,
right?
It's like, I mean, one could also make the claim that this was the most identity politics election win ever, i.e. white nationalist identity politics.
Yes.
Right? So, like, it's not the identity politics that we typically talk about. And this was kind of, this is kind of the point of the Neil Painter piece in the New York Times over the weekend, right? That, like, this is, like, whiteness finally recognizing itself as an actual...
As an identity politic. Yeah. That's an interesting way.
That's the Neil Painter.
Not even just, like, whiteness, but it's, like, not even whiteness in terms of, like, how Linda Alkoff has been describing it. Like, because even that becomes intersectional. It's a certain kind of whiteness. It's a style or genre of whiteness that comes out in this particular election that, you know, it defies kind of certain, I don't know, it doesn't even defy homogenizing perspectives. It is a homogenizing notion that seems to gather around certain central points that I've been struggling with because Emily, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, so the thing I was trying to get to in saying that I see how trying to think about neoliberalism as like an explanatory variable, all scare quotes on board, is because it's trying to get at some kind of anxiety that, like, we on the liberal coasts and in universities, like, don't see or don't have access to.
I'm in real America, so.
Okay, but you weren't always. But that you hear.
I'm on the coast, but we're, you know, Virginia is pretty.
You know what I mean. You know what I mean. One thing you hear is that if we're thinking about neoliberalism as an explanatory variable, then a kind of response we could have on the left is to like revamp or just invest, period, not reinvest, in a kind of leftist platform, which would involve an explicit institutional political move away from neoliberalism, which we might think of as something like raise the bottom, right? Like invest in a social net that does not leave people out to dry, arguably or not intentionally, right? And that's the thing I think is insufficient about focusing on just neoliberalism is because if you have to also think about that particular form of whiteness that you've all just been talking about as it works on a conception of what it means to belong to a citizenry and what our relationship as citizens is vis-a-vis the institutions that are responsive to us. Because I mean, I can't imagine a platform that would capture that white nationalist fervor that would, where the politics of it is invest in social welfare. Like right, that's the solution to all of our economic problems is investing in social welfare, because you still have the strain of white nationalism says that's not us. That's not me. Like, I don't, there's,
well,
nothing.
So William Connolly way back when, right. He writes about this in Ethos of Pluralization, where he's talking about, I can concede, he says, to an identity of white middle class or lower middle class voters having an identity that says, you know, especially with an ethos that says you are straddled by responsibility. It is personal autonomy and agency all the way. You are responsible for your own actions, your own ethics in terms of work. And if you don't live up to those standards, you suffer as a result. They look around, they see that there are folks somehow, and again, somehow I'm using this in scare quotes, coming forward, rising above the fact that they see themselves as working and not those others, right? As I use in a very large bracket. And those others seem to be benefiting from the welfare state, and they aren't. And thus this identity becomes a source of, you know, the way Connolly presents it in this Nietzschean way, resentment. And it, as a result, it creates the space in which folks continuously move forward. This is not something new. This has been studied. You know, this has been something that has been in the back of our minds for quite some time. This disaffected population that, you know, is not only holding others accountable for their own inability, quote, inability to act and work, but not recognizing the work that's being put into the economy. And so there's a larger question of, you know, following Sadia Hartman here, following Fred Moten, asking the question about the whole ethos of work in general, which I don't think is obvious. It's not going to be answered in an election. It's not going to be answered in terms of, you know, sort of everyday conversation in the next 2 years. But I feel like these are things that, you know, it contributes to this discourse. It contributes to, you know, authorizing a discourse in which folks can sit around and say, oh, you're not working hard enough. Oh, well, you know, now as a result of not working hard enough, and I have been working so hard, now that I am competitively against you and you against me, I can make these claims that seem so central to Trump's candidacy and his campaign. And it's quite terrifying because there's this, you know, there's a kind of burden, a self-fashioned burden that everyone seems to share. But it's a burden that has been constructed. It's a burden that seems to be terrifyingly and ominously real. But it's one that, you know, at any given time can be given up. And I think that what Trump represents is the realization and manifestation of that burden is something that is real, and that, you know, it is on the shoulders of all to work hard. It's the Horatio Algiers of, you know, the 21st century.
Isn't this just like false consciousness? Like, I don't want to be like a vulgar, like, reductionist Marxist or something.
But I'm going to be a vulgar reductionist.
But I feel like, because I'm getting, this is my frustration, and I'm seeing this amongst like Black Studies people who are trying to like poke holes in the neoliberal narrative too, and say like, in some way, like putting some kind of almost ontological like divide between neoliberalism and white racism, or like lower class, which is just like, to me makes no sense.
It's all
sense,
the same
right?
thing. It's
and,
all the same.
And right, like, and I like, I mean, so I'm trying to think, right? Like, the Boys specifically called whiteness like psychological wages, right? And like, so all of this, because like, there's still even like that white working class, like, and if we're gonna overly like point to them as far as like Trump's like support too, right? But like,
But it was like they vote kind for of like him. The white middle class.
And it's the white middle class. Yeah.
You know, but like they're voting against their own interests, their own economic interests from an economic analysis, right? But like there's a false consciousness at work here that like their whiteness as a kind of quotient that is measurable or something that they're voting for is really just this like false consciousness, right? Yeah. Like it's the psychological weight that doesn't actually exist.
Well, yeah, and I mean, like for me, for me, it was like so. Thus, the people that I like thought about on last Wednesday were Du Bois, right? I was thinking about Marxism and the Negro Problem because like my class had been reading that, like they were supposed to have read that for that day. One of my classes. And then the other one is David Roediger's Wages of Whiteness, right? Which is like picking up on the Du Bois idea and kind of spinning it forward.
I mean, yeah, it seems to me like, because this is what I'm disheartened a little bit, and I'm not going to say the name of the scholar who I saw post this like Facebook post. But I really respect her. In
if
Black
we had
Studies,
recorded
and...
it 2 hours later, if it was extra dark,
yes, right. I just
extra dark.
Listen, I don't want to throw it out there because I really like her, and I still want to just don't want that out in public that I'm saying something about this scholar and disagreeing. But so anonymously though, I'm disagreeing. This Facebook post was telling left progressives and like radical white leftists that there is no such thing as the white working class, basically. And I was just like, why are we going to, in the fallout of this, continue to entrench the political identity side of this? And like, because I'm thinking about moving forward, we really need a robust anti-capitalist movement that's going to be able to be intersectional, but it's going to have to be anti-capitalist at its core. And I don't think we have enough
like
of
Hartman,
that.
I hope that Hartman wasn't the person who said this, because I feel
it wasn't Hartman.
Thank God, because I feel like offers a way out here, you know, in the sense of like developing an ethos of self-fashioning through work, of developing something through that kind of Weberian work ethic, you know, that Protestant notion of work that's been, you know, shouldered upon every individual in a religious manner. You know, I feel as though there has been moving forward this idea that somehow, you know, Black folks and minorities of all, you know, stripes and genders have been advancing as a result of the social welfare state, when in fact it's the opposite. And it seems to be the case that, you know, that there's a creation of this, which is so odd that, you know, a scholar would make that kind of outrageous claim that there is no, you know, white working class, either consciousness or otherwise, you know, facticity of life, because it is there. It's there. It came out. It emerged.
I want to go to Emily on this, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Because Emily, like, when we were talking about what to discuss during this episode, one, like, two of the questions you raised, I think, are especially important here. So I'm going to put you on the spot to, like, bring in what you were thinking. So like one of the questions that you said we might consider talking about was how we should think about the ways that whiteness is working on the left in the response to the outcome of the election, and also like what we do with intersectionality in relation to the elections. Like, what were you kind of thinking along those lines?
I think I'm thinking that James, I think you're right, that if whatever we do next, it needs to be deeply anti-capitalist. But I think one of the things I'm finding sort of like frustratingly insufficient about that is that it doesn't, if we're really going to think about who is the we that's moving forward with this anti-capitalist fervor, we can't negate the racism and we can't negate the sexism that affected or infected somehow the outcomes of this election. And I don't think the we can build that will be deeply anti-capitalist will be we enough to fully be anti-capitalist if we're not talking about whiteness and we're not talking about maleness or patriarchy.
Yes.
And I don't know how to do that, except that my, you know, biggest intellectual indebtedness to being able to think that way to begin with are intersectional Black feminist thinkers. And I feel like we decided the 90s were over and we were done with intersectionality and we moved on to fancier things. And yeah. Now I'm like, we need intersectional, like, Black feminist Marxism to, like, really think about what it would mean to be radically anti-capitalist and radically anti-capitalist as a somewhat, like, lowercase d democratic collective, you know?
So go back,
like,
to Lord and Collins and folks that came forward with these kinds of, and even Crenshaw to that matter, you know, that brings together these
funny, constellations of thought. And it sounds almost like old standards or something, right? Like, you're right, Emily.
Like a rear guard, in a way.
Right, like, that's like, yeah, like, we've moved on from that. But, like, I don't understand. Yeah, no, we need to get back to that.
Can I put a plug in for the piece that my class read for yesterday?
Yes.
They read Gloria Joseph's piece. What's the name of it? I'm forgetting the title of it. But it's her critique of Marxist feminism. For arguing that what Marxist feminism accuses Marxism of doing, i.e. making all its categories totally gender blind, white Marxist feminism does the same to Marx and to feminism, that it just makes all of those categories race blind, right?
White, yeah.
Yeah.
So. I also think, too, that one of the interesting things that the feminism of identity politics in the 90s, however old-fashioned we might think of it now, is I think that it actually engaged productively with the question of who are we trying to reach as a movement, and, like, to what extent do we engage the oppressor in our thing, right? Because I think what intersectionality also begs us to ask is, like, whether do we in this instance call whether or not how real it is the white working class, who in some ways we want to sympathize with their plight as victims of neoliberalism, to what extent do we equate them or make them analogous with the oppressor, right? Mm-hmm. And to what extent do we engage them in our in our radical anti-capitalist movement away from the status quo. And I don't think that's settled. And I think everyone said that's a stupid question and just, like, moved on to something else. And we never figured out what do we do with the oppressor, or how do we even know who the oppressor is. I'm using so many scare quotes, I want to die.
You know what I mean? We've been asking those questions in this podcast since, like, Sasia Soskin's work in Expulsions, where we're talking about the oppressor isn't even known, in the sense that once it becomes an algorithm, once it becomes mathematical, how does one even deal with that question in terms of, like, yeah, neoliberalism in scare quotes, all of a sudden we're dealing with neoliberalism and the ghost of it, or the bracketed haunting of it. But I think, like, at the same time, if we're asking questions of intersectionalism, which I think needs to be asked, intersectionality, then we're also asking ourselves, you know what, whose bodies need to come forward now? Whose bodies need to be within the space that, you know, I think hitherto has not been in the space of, as ultimately has been in kind of that so-called rear guard, where thinkers within the intersectional vein have been the avant-garde, have come forward and said, look, race and gender and all of these things matter. We have been dying and educating and otherwise, especially if we're dealing with Audre Lorde, right? Educating folks, the oppressor, to ease the conscience, as well as to the fact that we need to, like, on some level, create spaces. On some level, I think this is, Emily, what I read or what I hear is a call to, you know, what I think Brittany Cooper has already said is, like, white folks coming forward and, like, claiming their own. White folks coming forward and, like, organizing in such a way as being taking advantage of a privilege that has already been there, that, you know what, we have not taken advantage of, other than saying total revolution, because we don't know what it means to say total revolution, because we're too interested in our own kind of conception of it. And we've forgotten that, hey, Black bodies, queer bodies, non-normative bodies are the ones dying first.
Can I say one more thing? Yes, and I also think another series of conversations we keep having over and over again on this podcast are questions about the way that capitalism and late capitalism engages in the co-optation of things and aspects of people and actions, right? So we talk all the time about to what extent we're complicit in the perpetuation of our own, you know, our own whatever oppressions. And I think that, like, the kind of nuance that invites is hard to deal with when you're thinking about organizing around a radical politics to combat something. Are you showing me this book? Because it's speaking to my point right now. But that it's not so clear that being white by itself is the thing that I need to think about when I do my radical politics. I think it's also about, like, what am I buying? What am I consuming? You know, that there's like this total, there's so many layers of ways that we engage with the world, with the economy, that has effects on bodies, but that also has consequences for perpetuating the capitalism that we are supposedly trying to organize in response to. And that, like, how you to figure out how that shit works is enormously complicated and, like, insanely,
it becomes ordinary.
It does not amount to isolating a variable and saying this is the thing we need to fix.
It becomes ordinary in a way. Like, it's the ordinariness
action. James, let's go to go to James.
Well, this is why I feel like this is what I feel intuitively, but, like, I don't know if I could actually explain it in any, like, good way or something. But, like, I'm tired of post-structuralism. And I want more Marxism again, like, just because Marxism allows me to centralize just a little bit more and just kind of, like, form a plank around something and just, like, organize, because all this, like, over nuance and the understanding of power as being, like, diffused and generated within, I mean, I get that, I do, right?
Okay, like, I don't think that's what I was trying to say, though.
But, like, this is what I feel like. I feel like we're getting short-circuited because we're worrying about so many like, the intersections don't stop. Deleuze and Guattari say blow it up by, like, overly multiplying it, right? Like, multiplicity becomes the way to, like, explode. I can't go through. Like, I don't know. This is what in my head, I feel like we have these two choices. We can start going back to the Marxist way of just, like, essentializing class or something. And, like, we can try to be more intersectional, but that's even going to be, essentialized intersectionality.
What does that even
mean? Or we go the Deleuze and Guattari way and just keep multiplying intersectionality to blow it up through multiplicity. But, like, then our politics are going to be like what they are now, where, like, one group of people organizes around something overly essentialized and they win. And the rest of us, because we're all nuanced with our intersectionalities, can't get anything off the ground well enough to form a numerical plurality that's big enough in this stupid electoral system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think what I was trying to say is not that I didn't mean that figuring out how to be anti-capitalist and figuring out how to be good, make good on our identity politics as theoretical things invite all this nuance. I think as actual action, they also invite, like, a lot of confusion. And I'm thinking about the case of, like, how to figure out what the fuck we do about climate change, right? Because we have this problem where we, in order to survive in some ways, we have to buy into a system that we now know is destroying the planet, right? But, like, how can we do our research to prove that it's happening without buying our computers that are made from materials that are mined or, you know, like, ravaged from the earth that we know has negative side effects. So I think that just in terms of figuring out what do we do, that the conundrum of neoliberalism and identity politics still works on us in this way. Like, how do we figure out how to organize our lives vis-a-vis the economy? Like, what shit do we buy in order to not be white supremacist racists? Like, I think that's a question we have to think about.
I agree. Like, all right, so here's what I'm thinking. So we have, like, 10 minutes-ish. What I want to do...
Only 10?
I have three questions written down. I would like to pose one of these questions to each of you, and you, like, get a minute to respond. Then each of us gets, one more sentence to add on to that. Can we play this game?
Sounds like a presidential debate.
Yes, that is. I'm Anderson Cooper. That's the idea.
Oh, God. I guess that's a better choice.
All right, my first question is a question for James.
Wrong.
Wrong.
I'm just being our president.
James.
No.
Is fascism a useful word for us to use right now to describe what is happening?
Is fascism a useful word to use right now? I have a minute. I'm going to say yes, because I think it gets people's attention enough. And, like, you know, it gets people's attention with the risk that they feel like we've done it already or something, we move beyond. But I think it's better to say fascism than, like, Hitler and Nazi comparisons. Fascism is much more tangible almost than, like, the last extreme, which is Nazism, right? But, like, fascism, there's no reason why fascism couldn't, right, come draped in a flag, whatever that famous quote is here in this country, right? And, like, I'm just thinking of, like, Il Duce, you know, Mussolini, right? Like, that style fascism, like, people in Italy still, like, brag about, like, he got the trains to run on time and, like, this stupid kind of stuff, right? So, like, it's not always going to be scary in your face, fascism. But fascism describes exactly where we are, yes.
B, Emily, any responses to fascism?
I totally agree.
I'm so on board, like that train that you were talking about. I think that fascism follows populism. Populism, I think that has a very, populism is a kind of kind word to describe a nativism that has a purity to it. I think that the purity is often.
Time, B, it's my turn. So you get one sentence. You get your own 1 minute question. You get one sentence in response.
Oh, I didn't understand the
rules of the game. Yeah. We're all just playing a game. The rules of which John made up.
Playing by the rules of the game.
Okay. So my one sentence is that there's left populism and right populism, and right populism might be the thing that goes to fascism. And I otherwise agree with James. All right, Emily. My question for you is. Are we all really bad leftists? If we
wait, does Emily get a response?
Gets a minute. Emily,
a whole minute.
Emily passed her response to fascism, so she gets an extra 10 seconds.
I actually do have a sentence response. I do think that one thing that's a kind of a difficult thing about fascism as a explanatory category or whatever is that we only have sort of one general historical period that we think of as fascism now, and so I think we'll still need some time away from this to figure out whether it was in fact fascism when we move away from it. But I think there's no harm in calling it fascism whatsoever if your goal is to not have it.
All right. Emily, can I just real quick question for you
we don't get it
is are we all bad are we terrible leftists if we feel a tiny bit sad that, as you put it, we don't have a lady prez?
I don't know if I need a minute to talk about this. I think so. I posed the question, spoiler alert, to my colleagues because it's something I've been struggling with, and because I value all your opinions. So I hope you'll take your sentence and jump in after me. But this is a contradiction that, if it is in fact a contradiction, I think I've resigned myself to being okay with living with. I'm sad about it. I still would like a lady prez.
James,
that's all I have to say.
I don't think that. Repeat the question again. No. Have we failed? Okay, well then I will play.
Terrible leftists if we kind of wanted a lady prez?
I don't think we are terrible leftists to want a lady prez. No, we are not terrible leftists.
Oh, you agree with me?
I don't know how I feel about this because I don't know how I feel about Obama being the first black president and how that like I don't. All I'm thinking of is Vertreiten and Darstellung, but like representation and representation, visual representation and an actual like political representation. I don't know if the visual representation, I don't know how I feel about that as a politics.
Hegelian. I feel like a bad leftist because I realized as it got closer and closer to the election that I had more liberal feminism in me than I thought, and that I thought that there was symbolic value of a white neoliberal woman president still was quite meaningful. All right, B, your turn.
Vertreiten. I don't want the German people to get upset.
And they will.
They will.
The game is,
they're going to text. They're going to email. They're going to tweet.
Vertreiten and Darstellen.
Okay.
My German pronunciation is terrible.
B, you have 1 minute, and really only a minute, and I mean it.
Oh, I get it.
Rant.
Nice rib jab.
To rant against leftists, what you've been doing on Facebook. And now I am inviting you to do on the podcast.
I'm going to do it very quickly, if I may. I believe that leftists have, you know, a problem with organizational skills. I think that, you know, a lot of socialists believe that, this anti-Hillary romp was something that was productive. And in fact, I believe that they were repeating a narrative that was on the right. I think that on many levels, they were not critical enough of their own perspective and their own discourse to see that on the right, the same kind of discursive aspects, the variables, the symbols, the phrases were being employed on the left. And as a result, I think they ultimately demobilized 6 to 9 million people who would have otherwise voted in favor of Hillary. And I believe that as a platform, Hillary would have been more able to take on the questions of trans, queer people of color, and for that matter, communities of color issues than someone like Trump. I believe that it's problematic that they could not have at least had the foresight to see it.
Yeah. Emily James, your response.
I will say quickly that I think this is one of the things we talk about, the kind of, so we talk a lot about capitalist co-optation of things on the podcast, but I think we talk less about right-wing co-optation, although I know it's come up in some conversations, but I think that's a kind of interesting sort of chicken and egg question, like which came first, right? Because we've seen historically that the right has this ability to like not only co-opt some leftist rhetoric, but like distill it and like sell it in this weird, sexy, not to me, but to some people way. And I think that it will be interesting when we've had some time to see like to what extent this is another example of that or a case of that.
My turn. I think there are no secrets. If you listen to everything I've ever said on this podcast, that I have this like Hegelian Marxist like streak that runs through. But like I've been teaching the dialectic this semester. And so like leftists, can we please just get back, sit back down and understand how thesis and antithesis works. And if Trump is the thesis of the GOP and you like your outcome is the middle, like then you need to run an antithesis that is like way far to the other side. So that way the dialectic pulls it into the middle. If you start with a middle like Hillary, like then where do you think this thing is going to end up? You're never going to get it further left. And so to the leftists, be a real actual leftist of the right. I mean, I don't understand where, like, it's just like the right is not afraid to mobilize their most radical rhetoric into operationalized politics. And the left, for some reason, is not like able to operationalize its most radical politics. And I don't understand. They don't try as hard.
All right. So I don't want my sentences. I don't want people to be angry on social media at me. Okay. So on that note. So James, you had another good idea that we're going to spin forward about the podcast and your journeys to ASA, and we an invitation to the listeners, although we're not sure if it's actually going to happen or not. So, but explain your idea, what you're going to be doing this weekend.
So this weekend, tomorrow from the day of this recording, tomorrow evening, I'm going to be flying to Denver, which is where the American Studies Association annual symposium will be taking place. Talking to some of my colleagues in my program, we think it's going to be really heavy this year because American Studies always drapes itself as like in crisis and like we're always responding to crisis. And that's normally the way it is. But this year's theme is home, not home. And it's centering indigenous land sovereignty disputes. This was the theme picked like a couple years ago for this year. So like Standing Rock was already going to be like this very crucial moment. Right. And I do also want to say the American Studies Association, we were the first academic association that voted to boycott the State of Israel in relation to the Palestine situation. So we're pretty radical people. And so this year's already had the backdrop of Indian land sovereignty, but now with Donald Trump being recently elected, I think the mood's going to be really interesting. And so I'm going to have an audio MP3 recorder with me, and whoever I get a chance to strike up conversation with at the conference, if they're willing to just give me, 5 minutes of their time and just I would like to see if we can get some kind of, like, if there is going to be a what do we do next, how do we start to mobilize and organize around intersectionality, then, like, let's test this out. I want to see what people are thinking, and maybe that episode of assembled voices can be our own, like, praxis, contribution to the movement.
As a podcast, so. You mean?
As a podcast, right. Our podcast is going to, you know, we're engaging this. We're here for the next 4 years or so.
We hope.
We hope, yes.
We're, you know, we don't endorse candidates. We don't do that kind of politics here, but we do engage, right? And I think we can be more, there's some weird feed. I suppose the NSA is already listening in. They don't like. We're coming for you, just like the ACLU had.
Oh my god!
Out
oh, it's just
Trump.
Tyler.
But this can be one site of, you know, the underground movement right here. We're not too underground though. We're on iTunes, so we're not that underground. But you.
Hi, so I was raising my hand. I also wanted to say one thing. As an American political scientist, which is so strange for me to say out loud, I think a lot of people need to be aware of the single member plurality districts and how that operates in terms of promoting a two-party system.
Duverger. It's more than, exactly,
the whole Duverger's law, but we should
post links to that video and Schoolhouse Rocks on this episode.
Yes.
The animal video with the political parties. Yeah, I love that one.
I think that, you know, honestly, it should promote a certain kind of activism against single member plurality districts. I think that we can contact legislatures, we can be more politically proactive about the way that the state is operating in terms of the selection of congressional members. It's within constitutional strictures. I think that people need to be aware of what is, you know, contained as in terms of, like, selecting members of the House as opposed to the Senate, and that, you know, in general, this is not something set in so-called natural stone. This is something that, you know, is at the hands of, you know, people who are, you know, actively engaged in making electoral politics happen. So I don't know. I wanted to make sure that that's something that comes out, because, look, the bottom line is a lot of people are very dissatisfied with two parties. Well, two parties come out of the system that we've had for quite some time. England is no exception. You know, it has a two-party plus system. It has one very minor third party that gets included. But, you know, we really are and do take the cake with the presidential single-member plurality district problem. So
here, here.
Right. We all want to, like, have, like, one more each, like, hopefully cathartic statement for the podcast before we sign off.
Yeah,
slash
I'm just
I,
gonna...
slash I want to do that, so I'm going to do that.
Yes,
I want to not monopolize that possibility.
I'm just going to say in closing that I didn't mean to sound overly pessimistic about the potential for a radically anti-capitalist movement to emerge out of this. I think it's possible, but I think I'm like weirdly nostalgic for scholarship from the 90s that thinks about intersectionality, and I want to do both.
Yeah.
I think that this is, like, the time when artists go to work and do their best work. I'm not, there's no justification for bad times being, like, the what brings us art, but just that if you are someone who is an artist or a creative, then, like, your skill set is most suited for these kinds of situations. So get to work, please.
I want to say that if you are trans, queer, any gender non-normative identity, that there are organizations that are out there to help you, especially through this difficult time in which you have now a kind of double effort to identify your space. And I think that it is now a time more than ever to reach out and to understand that people love you, care, and see you. And this is something that I have learned over the last week from my students at Purchase College, whom I adore. And anyone at Purchase who is listening, I adore you.
that you do have people who are advocating for you on a regular basis?
I'll go with the thing that I ended both of my classes with last Wednesday, and that is that, like, if nothing else, this is a helpful reminder that progress does not exist and technology does not exist, and, like, there's no guarantee that at the particular kind of social and political world that we want to come into being will come into being on its own, and that, like, ultimately the only thing that we have is politics, and by that I mean not elections, but, like, people working with and against, and it's always both of those, with and against one another, to, like, bring those social and political worlds into being, right? And that, like, collective work is what politics is, and that's the only thing we have.
Amen. Snapping fingers.
On that note, shall we sign off?
Yeah, we love all of you listeners. I love all of you, James and B and Emily.
I love you too.
So much.
Bye, friends.
Bye, listeners.
Bye.
Bye.
Already podcast, which is created by Rachel Brown, Emily Crandall, James Paladini Jr., E. Altman, and John McMahon. Visit our website, alwaysalreadypodcast.wordpress.com. Email us texts you'd like us to discuss, advice, questions to answer, and dreams to analyze to alwaysalreadypodcast@gmail.com. We'd like to shout out our Patreon supporters. A triple thank you to the Always Already Circle of Trust, Matthew R. and Matthew S. A double extra thank you to Tumblr BFF, parentheses from Canada, Steve K. And a thank you to a friend of the podcast, Angel L. We'd also like to thank Bunny and Leica for supporting us without claiming any of the rewards. You, listener, can support us at patreon.com/alwaysalreadypodcast. Thank you to our friend Leah Dion for the intro music, her static loops, and to B for the cover of Landslide that you're hearing right now. Look out for potentially another election-related episode from us, bringing in some of our friends and listeners and colleagues and compatriots and comrades in all of this. And until then, have an always already day. Sorry, hold on. I think B is calling in. So maybe this is going... Oh, wait. Uh-oh, okay.
So funny.
Hi.
Oh.
Success?
Maybe.
How does this work?
Oh. Hold on.
I thought it was like four panels. I thought you were the door.
We had... Oh, sorry. No, that's all.
Yeah, that's all you said. I was like, wait, what's going on?
We had a long pause after you said, hold on, I think B's coming in, so we can edit this out in post if we need to.
Okay, now B might actually be coming. So, like, the accelerationists.
B!
B!
That sounds frightening.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Yay.
Oh, my God.
That looks like it's going to work. Hi, B.
Hi.
Hi, Tyler.
Hello, look at you with like a study behind you and all. You look so academic.
Fancy. Oh, and your pony looks so great.
He's got a stop it.
Stop it. You guys are just ridiculous. Oh,
okay,
man.
I see everyone.
I see everyone. Nice.
All right.
So we took a little pause in the middle of the conversation, so we're going to have to try to figure out a kind of smooth way to get back there.